worshipping Lord Vishnu with all paraphernalia, such as water for washing his feet, hands and mouth, and water for his bath. One must offer him various presentations for his worship, such as garments, a sacred thread, ornaments, scents, flowers, incense, and lamps. Actually, there is a very short purport to this one. It says, this mantra is very important. Anyone engaged in deity worship should chant this mantra as quoted above, beginning with Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya. And number 8, Sukadeva Goswami continued, after worshipping Lord Vishnu with all the paraphernalia mentioned above, one should chant the following mantra while offering 12 oblations of ghee on the sacred fire. Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya Maha Vibhuti Pataye Swaha. And this is number 9. Okay. Sriyam Vishnum Chavaradav Asisam Prabhavav Ubhav Bhakcha Sampujaya Nityam Yadi Chet Sarva Sampada Shriyam Vishnum Chavaradav Ashisham Prabhava Vubhav Bhakcha Sampujaya Nityam Yadi Chet Sarva Sampada Shriyam Vishnum Chavaradav Ashisham Prabhava Vubhav Bhakcha Sampujaya Nityam Yadi Chet Sarva Sampada. Others. Late. Ladies. Sriyam Vishnu Chavarada. Shriyam, the goddess of fortune. Vishnum, Lord Vishnu. Cha, and. Varado, the bestowers of benedictions. Asisam, of blessings. Prabhavo, the sources. Ubhav, both. Bhaktya, with devotion. Sampujayet, should worship. Nityam, daily. Yada, if. Ichet, desires. Sarva, all. Sampada, opulences. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. If one desires all opulences, his duty is to daily worship Lord Vishnu and his wife, Lakshmi. With great devotion, one should worship him according to the above-mentioned process. Lord Vishnu and the Goddess of Fortune are an immensely powerful combination. They are the bestowers of all benedictions and the sources of all good fortune. Therefore, the duty of everyone is to worship Lakshmi Narayan. Purport. Lakshmi Narayan, Lord Vishnu, and Mother Lakshmi are always situated in everyone's heart. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hriday Shay Arjuna Tishtati. However, because non-devotees do not realize that Lord Vishnu stays with his eternal consort Lakshmi within the hearts of all living entities, they are not endowed with the opulence of Lord Vishnu. Unscrupulous men sometimes address a poor man as Daridra Narayan or poor Narayan. This is most unscientific. Lord Vishnu and Lakshmi are always situated in everyone's heart, but this does not mean that everyone is Narayan, especially not those in poverty. This is a most abominable term to use in connection with Narayan. Narayan never becomes poor, and therefore can never be called Daridra Narayan. Narayan is certainly situated in everyone's heart, but he is neither poor nor rich. Only unscrupulous persons who do not know the opulence of Narayan try to afflict him with poverty. Krishna Pastai Budale, Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminita Namane, Namaste Saraswati Devi, Govardhani Pacharne, Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacharya Chatarne, Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Pabuna Chananda, Sri Advaita Gadadar, Shivasati Govardha Bhakti Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. excuse me, where does this idea come from in the first place? You know, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead becomes poor men. And by worshiping all the poor men, you're worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What's the origin of this? You know, it's a rhetorical question. well, actually, Prabhupada explains that it's actually something that was... Well, go ahead. What's the origin of this thing, the original Orion? That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada said it was manufactured by Vivekananda. He referred to it as this demonic declaration. And it was manufactured by Vivekananda. And, you know, it's just a total concoction. And really, it was something that was, as you'll hear in a second, invented by him for the purpose of cheating people. These are two excerpts from lectures Prabhupada gave where... He was, you know, speaking about this particular point. Actually, it came up about 72 times just in Prabhupada's lectures. And so here's one of them. Prabhupada says, in the Bhagavad Gita, we don't find anywhere a single line that you raise funds for, I mean to say, giving relief to the poor or to the suffering. Is there any instruction in Bhagavad Gita you have read? Can you find out? But these people, they have become more learned than Krishna. In our country, Vivekananda, Daridra Narayan Seva. The whole Ramakrishna mission is collecting funds only on this rascal plea. Once Swami Nikalananda, he told me, now the Americans are questioning that you are raising funds for feeding the poor, but when we go to India, we see simply poor men. So what are you doing with this money? That's... And that Swami Prabhupada goes, actually, they are doing nothing. They are collecting money in the name of feeding the poor, and they are living just like royal style, you see, eating all everything. So it's like a verbatim quote from a lecture of Prabhupada. And another one, Prabhupada says, there are so many men without shelter, without food. What have you done for them? The Ramakrishna mission began for Daridra Narayan Seva. They have got so many big buildings, institutions. Why the Daridra Narayan is lying on the street? What they are doing? Why don't they take the Daridra Narayan in the big building they have got? Their mission is Daridra Narayan Seva. Why they are not doing that? So Prabhupada's pointing out, you know, how it's just, as I said, it was just for the purpose of cheating people, and it's total hypocrisy. You know, they're just collecting money, playing on the sympathies of ignorant people. Unfortunately, you know, the entire population of India, well, is more or less ignorant after being under foreign subjugation for almost, well, over 1,000 years. They pretty much forgot their culture. Now, of course, they're being educated by the Krishna consciousness movement, but people don't know. You know, these guys come along, and at least specifically this person, Vivekananda, and he just claims that, oh yeah, by feeding the poor, taking care of the poor, you're, you know, by serving the poor, you're serving God. And they don't know, so they just, okay, you know, they have some sympathy. Oh, it's good to serve the poor, and if that's what we have to do, and you know, you won't bother us anymore, great, here, have some money, and we'll just continue on our merry way, working hard, making money, and just trying to enjoy our senses. And you know, they have that, can get that guilt, that then, you know, okay, I'm doing something for my spiritual life or religious life, giving this donation to this organization and like that. But it's all just a big, you know, it's the cheaters and the cheated, as Prabhupada's spiritual masters say, Bhaktisiddhanta. The cheaters are these people of the Ramakrishna mission, and the cheated are the general populace of India who were, you know, contributing money for this purpose. So as I mentioned, there was 72 different references from just the lectures alone where Prabhupada brought this up, and of course, in each and every instance, he was criticizing it from different angles. Basically, he pointed out that these people are atheists, and this is some of their rhetoric that, you know, comes from specifically Vivekananda. Prabhupada would say that, putting, you know, what's the word? Just saying what Vivekananda would say. Why are you bothering yourself to find out God? Don't you see so many gods are loitering in the street? And then also, he would say, there is no God. This is, you know, also the preaching of these people. There is no God. I am God. Why are you searching out God? The God is loitering in the street. So like this. This is the kind of, you know, thing you would hear from them. And so Prabhupada, in these different references, you know, throughout his lectures where he brought up this subject, he criticized this from different angles of vision. One from Shastric, another from, you know, philosophy, logic and argument, and then also on practicality. In other words, he leveled three different categories of accusations or criticism against this concept or concoction, would be more appropriate to call it. So as far as the Shastric ones go, Prabhupada pointed out in one lecture that according to the Shastra, it's even an offense to think of elevated demigods like Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma as being on the same level as Lord Narayan. I mean, every morning we say, I think it's the second offense, to consider the names of the demigods like Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma to be equal to or independent of the name of Lord Vishnu. And also there's a famous quote, yes tu Narayanam Devam Brahma Rudradi Devatai Samat Vainaiva Vikshaita Sapasandi Bhaved Dhruvam. That anybody who considers even these elevated demigods like Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma to be on the same level as Lord Narayan is an offender. And as far as this concoction goes of, you know, the poor people becoming Lord Narayan, and, you know, they probably have some whole story how it's actually a glory of Narayan that he's, you know, coming in this way. But there's another Shastric statement where it says, Achana Karila Shrestha Ishvara Mahatva, which means that any glorification of the Lord in which his position is diminished is a great offense. So, once again, it's in that category. And then Prabhupada pointed out in another lecture that the actual position of Narayan is not Daridra, poor Narayan, you know. Narayan's position is Lakshmi Sahasra Satasam Brahma Savyamanam, which is that he's worshipped by hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune. Not one, Prabhupada would say, but hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune. That's the real position of Narayan, not that he's Daridra. And then Prabhupada would give the example of how in Dwarka, Krishna had 16,108 goddesses of fortune serving him. And And each one of them had their own marble palace bedecked with jewels. There was no need of light because the light came from the effulgent jewels. And so Prabhupada's describing how Krishna manifested his opulence quite to the contrary of this idea of Daridra, that he expanded himself into 16,000 forms. And he went on to make the point that he could have expanded himself into 16 million. And still, that wouldn't... Krishna's unlimited, so that even that would have not been a total display or a total manifestation of his opulence, even if he would have expanded himself into 16 million. What to speak of, just only 16,000. And as we heard, there's no mention of this idea in the Bhagavad Gita. Another thing that these people do is they criticize temple worship. They say, why? What is the use of this temple worship? Just worship Narayan as Daridra, Narayan as the poor man. And actually, if you analyze that, once again, according to the scripture, it's just like topsy-turvy. They've turned everything upside down. They're presenting the idea that if you worship the poor man, it's worshiping Narayan, but actually, the Shastric Siddhanta is the opposite of that. If you worship Narayan, then you're doing something to benefit not just poor people, but every living entity. And that's the verse, Taroa Mula Nisechanena Tripyanti Taskanda Bujapashaka Pranopaharach Cha Yatendriyanam Tataiva Savarhanam Atjuteja. That just like by watering the roots of the tree, that is distributed to all the leaves and branches. If you supply foodstuffs to the stomach, the whole body gets the benefit. So in the same way, that by properly worshiping Lord Narayan or Krishna, all living entities are benefited, poor people included, but not the other way around. And as far as, once again, this is another Shastric inconsistency, is that if you want to feed somebody, the Vedic version is Brahman Bhojana, not Daridra Narayan Bhojana. You feed the Brahmins because the Brahmins, qualified Brahmins are considered, they eat and speak on behalf of Krishna. So by feeding the Brahmins, you're feeding Krishna. That's the, if you want to feed somebody, that's who you're supposed to feed, not the poor people. Although certainly it's not considered a way of worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And as far as practicality goes, here's a philosophical. So Shastrically, they don't have a leg to stand on, and as far as philosophy, logic, and argument, it's not much better. Prabhupada, in one lecture, made this criticism. He pointed out that, just like people are in the condition they're in due to karma, due to reaction to past pious and mostly in Kali Yuga sinful activities. And Prabhupada gave an analogy. He said, just like by any means, you cannot get released a man who is condemned in the prison against the law. In other words, you can't just on some sentiment go in there and just say, it's such a shame that this person is suffering in jail. Let's go release him. No, the person's in there for a reason. They've committed some crimes and they're being punished. And it's not like some citizen, just because they have some sentiment, can come and just say, okay, let's get him out. So in the same way, people are in a particular condition of life in this material world that's as a result of past pious or sinful activities. And it's not that, just because of some sentiment, we're going to be able to change that. You're not going to be able to change that. It's not going to be effective. You can't, just pop away. Sometimes give the example of if you take a pig and you try to remove him from his eating stool and you try to serve him some nice halva sweetmeats, he won't be interested. He's a pig, and by his karma, he's destined to eat that stool. That's his food stuff. And so in other words, it's not practical in that sense, And then another one was, Prabhupada pointed out that, and it's mentioned here in the purport, how Lakshmi and Narayan are within everyone's heart. But Prabhupada said, once again, like sort of a logical argument against it, that just because Narayan is in everyone's heart, that doesn't mean that everyone has become Narayan. And he gave the example, you are within your coat. Therefore, are you your coat? I am in the room. Does that mean I've become the room? So he's just pointing out the logical fallacy of that argument that, Narayan is within everybody, therefore everybody's Narayan. No. Just Prabhupada clearly showed the logical fallacy there. And also he He made the criticism that he pointed out, very nice insight, that for the sake of one Dirijan Narayan, another Dirijan Narayan is being killed. And what he meant by that is that there are these people, at least, you know, who they're feeding them with flesh, goat flesh, which is obtained by offering a goat to the goddess Kali. And supposedly they're getting Kali Prasad. But what about the goat Dirijan Narayan? In other words, it's just the poor human beings that are Dirijan Narayan. What about, you know, so he's proper saying they're killing one, for the sake of one Dirijan Narayan, the poor human being, they're killing another Dirijan Narayan, these, you know, other living entities, innocent living entities who are being sacrificed to feed them. And then probably another criticism was, he said, the welfare activities are increasing, and the candidates for receiving the welfare, they are increasing. So it's not effective. It doesn't work. You know, if it was a good program, sorry, and they would be, corralling it in. There'd be less people who are needing that type of assistance, but it's not. The opposite is happening. So it doesn't work. And as I said, the hypocrisy was already mentioned earlier. I pointed that out in those initial quotes I read. So basically the idea is that in a lot of these, in general, Prabhupada's pointing out that these people in general, they don't know what real jiva-doya is. Jiva-doya means mercy to living entities. They don't understand what that is because they don't understand who we are. They don't understand that we're not this material body. And there's that famous verse in the Bhagavatam, see if I can get it now. Yasyat mabude tunape tudatuke swadi kalatradisu boma ijidi yatirta. Yatirta buddhi salile nakarichit janeshu abhigeshu saeva gokara. That, you know, people who think that they have this body, which is just a bag of mucus, bile, and air, and who think that the place of birth is worshipable, who think that you just go to a place of pilgrimage to take a bath in the water, and they don't make any effort to establish any kind of relationship with the saintly people there who could elevate them in spiritual understanding, then they're no better than an ass or a cow. And, actually, Dravida told me something interesting. It's actually it's not an ass or a cow. It's an ass and something. It's not exactly a cow, but it's an ass that carries the food for the cow or something like that. There's some technicality with the Sanskrit. It's not actually criticizing the cows as being stupid in that verse, but I can't remember exactly how it goes. But, yeah. So, you know, people are in ignorance, so they don't know what real jiva doya is. And, we should, just for our own understanding, we have nothing against feeding poor people. Matter of fact, we're more into feeding poor people than probably anybody else. And I'm sure we've fed more poor people in the last 40 years than the Ramakrishna Mission has fed in the, whatever it is, 100-something years that they've been in existence. But we intelligently know what to do. We feed them prasadam. So they actually can get some benefit. I mean, they get their belly full. I mean, they actually, you know, get relief from the distress of being hungry or starving or whatever, but you know, they're not getting further entangled in material existence as a result of eating foodstuffs that are just, as a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, that one who doesn't eats food that's not offered first in sacrifice verily eats only sin. Yeah? So we're not doing that to people. You know, we're not getting them further implicated in sinful life. We're actually helping them get out of the cycle of birth and death by feeding them prasadam, as Ganesh pointed out yesterday in that nice class he gave. He read that quote, which, clearly and forcefully made the point that by eating prasadam, one's brain tissues become sanctified, and then one's able to, you know, be receptive to getting the message of, spiritual knowledge. So we're doing that. So in this way, I think we could understand that this whole, Dirijan Narayan thing is just like, as Prabhupada pointed out, it's a concoction. And it was just a cheating thing. And so we shouldn't, knowing it for what it is as devotees, we, kind of shouldn't, if we come across it in our preaching or anything like that, be you know, get taken in by it, that it's anything other than just, you know, we should see it for exactly for what it is, just a scam, basically, to, you know, to victimize innocent people. So can anybody see the clock up there? I just want to... 8 o'clock. Okay, good. So I wanted to just take a few minutes to say a couple things about this. My trip to India, I guess, got back a couple days ago, and so I just wanted to give a... they might have any question or comment about this, you know, just all these different points I was making about Dhiraj and Orion, anything I didn't mention or anything that I mentioned that wasn't clear or anything. Everybody's kind of pretty clear on that. It was pretty... Okay. All right. So, I just got back from India. It was really nice. I spent a month in Mayapur, actually. And so I just wanted to kind of share with everybody some of the positive things I experienced, and there was quite a few of them. For one thing, the temple's going up really nicely, 24 hours a day. most of you probably seen it on the Mayapur website, and but when you're actually there, it's even like, you know, more impressive, a lot of impact. There's two huge cranes that, they must be like between 6 and 10 stories high that even, you know, way above the structure itself. They're up to the third floor and the structure. And as I said, the construction goes 24 hours a day. They have different crews. And you can see one crew leaving and the other crew coming. And so it's going on. And I heard an interesting story about how it all sort of came about. That, for years, this whole project wasn't going any place. You know, devotees, the GBC was wanting to do it, and devotees knew it was Prabhupada's instruction. He wanted the Adbhuta Mandir, but it just somehow or another, there was always one obstacle after another. And then at some point, partially out of desperation or just whatever, Bhakti Trumaraj came up with the idea, approached Ambarish, and they requested Ambarish to kind of get involved, meaning, you know, can you help us? Because they knew, you know, he had a lot of Lakshmi and he could do something. So Ambarish came back. His response was, yeah, but on the condition that, you know, I could just do it the way I want to do it and you guys don't, you know, no interference, please. And I'll take it on. And they agreed to that. So then after that, this devotee named Sadbuj, he's kind of like a construction manager. He's been there for many, many years. And he approached Ambarish and he suggested to him, he said, hey, you know, because there's all these different ideas about where it should be and how it should be, you know, what style architecture it should have and like that. So Sadbuj approached Ambarish and said, why don't we just do it the way that Prabhupada wanted it to be done? And Ambarish sort of, you know, I actually had Sadbuj told me the story. I went up and talked to him about it. And he said, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. Well, what's that? So he, you know, went on to explain to him that, okay, Prabhupada actually put a cornerstone where it is now, on the campus there. That's where the original cornerstone was laid. And this idea of putting it out in the field there, that came after, you know. And there's a problem. That land is not zoned in the same way, and there's always, like, some problem with that. Even though it looked like, well, put it out there, and then we could, you know, leave everything nice the way it is on the campus and just expand it. It was, you know, there was a problem with that. And then another thing that became a subject of controversy was the style of the architecture. And so... Sadbuj pointed out, because Sadbuj is, you know, he's close with Bhavananda, who actually was one of the co-directors for the Mayapur project at that time when Prabhupada was giving these instructions. And, you know, he was there when Prabhupada gave the instruction that he told Yadavar to go to the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. and take photos of the dome, because Prabhupada wanted that. He wanted that same thing for the, you know, for the temple of the Vedic. On this, you know, what is it they call it? Temple of the Vedic, Temple of Vedic Planetarium. Yeah, Temple of the Vedic Planetarium. So, Prabhupada knew what he wanted. And, you know, the proof of that is he sent Yadavar, and Yadavar went. And he came back with a whole bunch of photos of the dome there. So Sadbuj pointed this out to Ambarish, and Ambarish was real excited, you know, when he heard all. And he said, okay, let's do it. And as soon as they decided, as soon as they, you know, said, okay, they're just going to do it according to the original way that Prabhupada instructed, and at least according to Sadbuj, he told me everything just started falling in place, and just boom, 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 you know, and it all went. And, you know, we could see that that's, you know, it's going on. Now, apparently it's going to be, Ambrish has pledged like $25 million, but it's looking like it's, and the, you know, the kind of the understanding among those in the know is that it's going to be a lot more expensive than that. But, $60 million. So he's out fundraising, you know, he's trying, and also, I don't know, but it looks like it's going to come up. I mean, you know, Krishna's in control, and okay, well, that's 35, so 25 to go. And I asked, who did I ask? Hari Sari. They have pictures of it all over the place. You know, what it's going to look like when it's complete, because it's not just the temple, the grounds look, everything is like really. And I said, is it? And I actually went up to Hari Sari, who's kind of part of that committee, and I said, hey, is it actually going to look that good when it's done? And he said, better. So that was really far out. You know, that was kind of something that was inspiring to, yeah? Sure, go for it.
You know, there's, I went in the back where they were, the architects were doing the layout on computer, and I got a Bhavananda Prabhu, Tadit and myself through a whole tour.
Oh, okay.
So when we went into the layout and design office, he showed us a Vyasasan, Srila Prabhupada's Vyasasan that they're going to make there in Mayapur. And interesting story is that, I don't know, maybe some time back, I can't remember the exact, so I don't want to say any timeline, but what they did is that this one great sage had a dream one time. And in that dream, he envisioned a beautiful Vyasasan, a very gorgeous, heavenly Vyasasan. So he, in that dream, he recognized where it was, where it actually was, this Vyasasan was buried. So they actually found this Vyasasan. They actually found it. They dug it up. And then they realized that it was the Vyasasan of King Yudhishthira. It was his throne. And so they have that. So what they did is a replica of this particular throne. And that's what the Srila Prabhupada's Vyasasan will be in that temple. And it's practically indescribable for me to describe it to you. It's the most powerful chair that I've ever seen in my life. It's so beautiful and so ornate, so detailed, and so magnificent that it's very befitting Srila Prabhupada. So Bhavananda Prabhu was showing us this Vyasasan. It was incredibly gorgeous. I'm not artistic enough to describe it to you, but the curves and the swirls and the, you know, the regalness of this particular Vyasasana would be unbelievable. So 2016 they'll be ready.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly, for reminding me. 2016 is the date they want to move the deities in. Everything won't be you know, complete by then, but they feel they'll be ready to move the deities in at that point. And since you mentioned Bhavananda Prabhu's name, I just remembered something else that I either heard from him or somebody quoting him, that once he was walking with Prabhupada, and they were walking out towards the front of the property, where, you know, where the front is now, apparently everything, things are going to be all changed around when the temple, you're going to put a new road in, and, you know, everything's going to be shifted around. But so he was walking down, and he was right by that Chattai hut where Prabhupada first started out. Those of you know, us who are Prabhupada disciples, remember that originally there was that main road, and then, you know, there was you walked in, and there was a hut. And that's where Prabhupada stayed, I think, 72, 73, even 74. So Bhavananda was walking with Prabhupada, and he said to Prabhupada, I want to pull that hut down now. This was about like 75 or 76. I want to pull that hut down now because, you know, it doesn't look so good. It's a bit of an eyesore. And Prabhupada said, no, leave it, because I want them to see this is what we were. And he was standing right by the hut. This is the hut there, and this is Prabhupada standing it. And so there's the road there. And Prabhupada said, I want them to see this is what we were, and this is what we're going to become. And he pointed right to where the temple's going up right now. So that was kind of far out too, you know. And he made that point, you know, he pointed right where the temple is going up right now. Yeah, so that's as far as the temple goes. And then the thing I actually went over there for was this, yeah.
And that is that it, in comparison to Peter's Cathedral, this temple will be 14 feet smaller, and St. Peter's probably the largest religious shrine probably in the world, one of the largest. I think there's one other one that's larger. So this will be in terms of, you know, height and width and breadth, it'll be one of the largest,
religious buildings
in Asia. Yeah. And in April they're going to start on the dome, and that dome itself is going to be like 700 feet high. And when you're in the middle of the temple room floor, you'll be able to look up and see all the way to the top of the dome. So it's incredible. And that area, the temple room area, standing, there'll be 10,000 people able to stand at one time. That'll be the capacity of this temple, 10,000 people.
Well, you know, yeah. That brings me to the next point. We're going to need
every inch of it. There's 4 million people that visit a year right now in Mayapur. And from my knowledge, someone told me that some census was done a year or so ago. And the state of Florida only gets 5 million people a year as tourists. Hmm. That's the state of Florida. So this little...
Yeah, Florida's a tourist state.
It's a tourist state. Like, it's actually
Beach,
a tourist state. So already Mayapur itself, that little place there, has 4 million visitors a year. And when this happens, this will probably quadruple it. And it'll be very phenomenal. The entrance to it is facing west. It's like west.
Right.
And when the stairways going up to you saw how wide that was. It's phenomenal how wide the stairway will be up to the temple. And to get to the temple floor, you'll actually be on the second floor. And that whole entrance will be this thick glass that you'll be able to see through. You know, just beautiful. You know, this thick glass you see on skyscrapers, this, you know, tempered kind of glass. So that it'll all be glass, just completely unbelievable, breathtaking, gorgeous. And when you walk in, to the right will be Lord Nrisimhadev's own personal temple. And you go to the left, then there'll be BI, Bhaktivedanta Institute. And as you go up, you know, you can circle. And as you go up, you'll see the universe according to the Vedic version all around. It'll be around the dome. In other words, it doesn't cover the dome. You just go around. And there you'll see the creation according to Vedic version. And, of course, in the BI, they're going to have classes. They'll have seminars. They'll have, you know, scientific research, books. They'll have all kinds of paraphernalia there to invite world-renowned people to come and discuss this Vedic view of the creation itself. So it'd be a very, very most amazing building in all of Asia, no doubt.
Yeah, it's going to be impressive. I mean, I'm sure if you go on the Mayapur website, not only you can see the construction as it's going on, but they must have, I haven't checked, but I'm sure they have those pictures that they had plastered all over Mayapur. It shows you what it's going to look like when it's all done. I'm sure you could find that on the website. And if you haven't already done that, have a look, because it's really inspiring. Yeah.
The first level is also going to be the biggest pujari room that you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
It's so massive. The ceilings are about 30 feet high between floors. But when you walk into the pujari room, it's the same area as the upper part where all the deities are going to be. And so you can imagine, it's just out of this world.
Yeah.
You'll need a golf cart.
Yeah, it's a fact.
Yeah. Okay, so aside from that, which is, you know, a lot, some other inspiring things. So this ISKCON Leadership Sangha, which is what I actually went over there for. Bhajan Narayan Prabhu, for some reason, asked me to attend that. It was pretty far out. It was pretty impressive. What it was there was about like 300 devotees who showed up for that. And I think I didn't go around asking, but I think it was like people, temple presidents and devotees who were in charge of this project or that project, or, you know, it's just something, they're taking some responsibility and they were able to make it. And so they set up some pandals in an empty field, and one of them, the main one, they had about three of them actually, and the main one, when you went into it, it was like a palace. You know, it was like every bit as like opulent and nice as the inside of this temple, right, Suhas? It was really like beautiful, but it was all made of cloth. You know, and it's like in India they could do some far out things, and so that's where they had like all the devotees, the group sessions, the plenary sessions they called it, when all the 300 people were there and the GBC were there, and that was every morning in the beginning, and they also served prasadam there. And devotees felt it was really good. It was very, overall good experience, because the devotees who were there, they felt kind of honored and encouraged that the GBC was kind of investing in their training and education, so to speak, because, the the people who went, they had to make their own way over there. But, the room and board, the prasadam and the accommodation was free for that week. So, that was nice. And also it was pointed out to everybody that the average age of a GBC member is 60 now, so there's going to be some changes. And everybody was, that was something that came up, that we got to start thinking about who the new GBC is going to be and how, changing the guard, so to speak, or passing on the baton. That was sort of like a subject that was discussed. And then they had all these different seminars and devotees were attending that. But the overall, feeling, it was a very strengthening, strengthening sense of community. I don't know quite how to put it, but I remember this, when I was sitting there in some of these sessions, I kept remembering this thing that, it sort of like inspired a mood of almost patriotism towards ISKCON. And I remember this thing I learned when I was, a kid in school, about there was this one guy in the Revolutionary War. His name was Nathan Hale. He was a spy, for the good guys, for the Americans. And he got caught, and they were going to execute him. So back in those days, they did things a little bit honorably. They asked him, well, what are your last words? And he said, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. He was like a real patriot right to his last breath, so to speak. And then they shot him, of course. But, the idea being, it was kind of like, you could see that kind of feeling was getting going there. Everybody was feeling like, they're really proud and to be a member of ISKCON. And, wow, it was like pretty far out that you could, something was happening. You could feel it. It was, in the air, so to speak. So that was really nice. And then there was the Nabadeep Mandal Parikram, and I didn't get to go on that. Unfortunately, I kind of got sick right before it began. But I did on the last day. They divided up into different parties. There was an international party, a Bengali party, and two Russian parties, each about 1,000 devotees. So at the beginning of the last day, they all meet at the Yogapith. So I saw, at least I got to go out there for that and see what's going on. So I got on a rickshaw and I was, got out there, and I was talking to this other devotee who I knew years ago. And then when we got to the spot, he was with his wife. He just hopped off and they just went off. And there I was, standing there. I was looking at this road and I saw, there was like three or four roads. And as far as I could see on any of the roads, all you could see was devotees. And apparently there was more than just four parties there. There was ISKCON had four parties, but Narayan Maharaj had a party there, the followers of Narayan Maharaj, and it was a big, sizable party. Then there's another group called Vrinda, who is like, it's the organization of another Prabhupada disciple, so they had a party, and then there was like a local Bengali party. So there were seven parties, and they were all converging on the Yogapith. They couldn't get in. Physically, there was, it was just, Yogapith is not that big. It's only maybe the size of this temple room, probably bigger than that, but, there was no question. All the devotees were backed up on these roads for as far as you could see. It was pretty far out experience, And then I didn't even bother trying to go to the Yogapith. I just went into this big field where they were serving out prasadam, and devotees were kind of going up and hugging each other, and that was pretty, pretty nice. And then after the Nabadeep Mandal Parikram, when we're back in the Mayapur, the temple room was packed. Bhakti Purushottam Swami, who was he's actually the GBC for Mayapur, he made an announcement that this is the biggest turnout we've ever had for a Mayapur festival. He said there's twice as many devotees registered for this one as we've ever had. And I think he threw out a figure there, 8,000 or something like that. And I could believe him, because at Mangal Arati, both sides of the temple room were packed, literally, like you didn't have much room, you know. And that was like on the Panchatattva side and Radhamadhava side. And so like that was pretty far out, just being in, you know, so many devotees there. It had a lot of, you know, potency. And as somebody mentioned, there's a lot of Russian devotees there. I mean, actually, I don't, probably about 60, 70, maybe 80%. And I was kind of impressed, you know. I was kind of observing them. I don't speak any Russian, but I was observing. I got to actually give Bhagavatam class to the Russian devotees one day. That devotee Uttama Shloka was my translator. He invited me. So, and they look nice, you know. They're really, they're very together looking, you know. I mean, I was just watching how they kind of like, you know, relate to each other, and they, you know, they didn't look at all neurotic, and they really look very, you know, relaxed and confident and competent. And I felt like, wow, these are some pretty far out people that have, you know, come join our movement. So that was really nice. I remember I went to one darshan. I bumped into Indradyumna Maharaj, who is, you know, it's kind of an old friend, and he told me to come to a darshan he was having in the evening. So I went there one evening, and it was just all Russians. It was all Russians, and he was, you know, it was very very elementary stuff he was speaking, you know, and so he'd speak and then they translate it. So it was kind of dressed. So I decided I didn't want to stick around. So as I was leaving, I was going down the stairs to just, you know, just kind of find my shoes and sneak off, you know. And this other devotee comes and he taps me and he says something in Russian, and you know, I go. And he keeps talking in Russian. And it was like, for him, it was incredulous. I mean, you don't speak, everybody speaks Russian. What do you mean you don't speak Russian? You know? It was like a reverse, you know. He looked at me like, you don't speak Russian? You don't understand what I'm saying? And I said, spasibo, spasibo. I don't know what that means. I think it means thank you or something. Or please, I didn't. And then he realized what was going on. He started laughing. And I said, okay, das vidanya. And he goes, das vidanya. So yeah, that was pretty far out. And the other positive thing was that it was very inspiring to see some of our stalwart leaders are just as stalwart as they've ever been. Yeah, Gopal Krishna Maharaj was up there practically every morning doing Mangala Arati for Panchatattva, and Chai Patak Maharaj doesn't, you know, still preaching up a storm. I bumped into him. He was every day. He was going out. You know, they were driving him out to one of the different parikrams so he could preach, and one morning he was just sitting in his car waiting for the, you know, to get going, and I went over to say hello to him. And he said, so, are you coming on the safari? And he's doing, after the whole Mayapur festival, he's taking a whole group of devotees on a safari. Like, they have this, he goes all over southern India and different places of interest. And I was thinking, wow, you know, he's amazing. I mean, certainly being concerned about his health is not his top priority. I guess it's a priority. He's following the footsteps of Prabhupada. His top priority is how to inspire the devotees, how to spread the Krishna consciousness movement, and whatever happens with me, well, that's up to Krishna. But that's obviously what his top priority is. And I was really inspired by his example. And last but not least, our own Dravida, hometown boy, did every morning they had him come up in front of all the devotees, right after Mangala Arati, just before they made the announcements, and he chanted a shloka, and then he gave his poeticized version of the translation, and he was doing that every morning for the whole month we were there, and devotees really liked that. So those were some of the highlights for me. You know, so I don't want to. So anybody have anything they want to add or question? Okay.
Chinese
were there in numbers, and of course Bengalis. There's a lot of Indian devotees there. Actually, the movement is like spreading really big in India and in Russia, which is kind of far out if you stop and think about it. I mean, I was at the, Savas might have been at that one too, the second to last Mayapur festival in 1976, and there were no Russians, and there were practically no Indians. We weren't making Indian devotees, you know, when Prabhupada was around. That was a complaint of Prabhupada's, you know. And but now, some, you know, like, I mean, Krishna's amazing. You know, you can't tell what, you don't know what's going to happen. Now Russia is like, China's maybe the next place to explode. Something like that. You're a lot. Okay, we'll stop. Gunter Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.